Welcome to Wisdom Rebellion, where we are figuring out how to improve our health, relationships, and family life with the help of the world's leading experts in how we get there, one challenging conversation at a time. Joining me today is Dr. Alka Siegel-Cuthbert, an educator, academic, author, and campaigner. She's the director of Don't Divide Us and has been a key voice in advocating for impartiality in education and democratic discourse. Alka began her career teaching English literature in inner city London and has served on Ofsted Advisory Panel on English. She is an author of several educational texts and has participated in numerous conferences and parliamentary inquiries. In 2017, she joined the Brexit Party to protest against what she saw as a potential democratic deficit if the popular vote were not respected. In today's conversation, we delve into the mission of Don't Divide Us, an organization founded in response to rise in critical race theory and divisive ideologies in schools. We discuss the impact of these ideologies on education following the George Floyd murder in 2020 and the subsequent concerns raised by parents and teachers. Alka shares insights on the harmful effects of introducing political agendas into the classroom, including accusations against young children for not conforming to certain narratives. We also explore the need to distinguish education from activism and the broader implications for children's development and democracy. I hope you enjoy the conversation. The organizations such as Don't Divide Us shouldn't really exist in a modern intelligent society. And yet, here we are. We shouldn't really have a need for organizations such as yours. What did you see out there that made you start Don't Divide Us?
Well, what we were faced with was a lot of responses coming in from mainly parents and some teachers shortly after the George Floyd murder in 2020. And these responses were all, there was a common theme to them all, was that they couldn't really understand why schools seemed to be, you know, parents, their children's school or teachers where they were teaching, suddenly seemed to have decided that the country they lived in, the school that their children went to or the schools that they worked at, were so racist that they needed to have a sort of introduce specific new deprogramming initiatives, you know, to make them actively anti-racist and to teach about white supremacy and to teach about white privilege. When for years, children have been going to these schools, teachers have been teaching at these schools, and there have been no problems. Or, you know, if there have been problems, if there have been incidents of racism, they've been very isolated, concrete instances that the schools and teachers have dealt with there and then. But suddenly we were being asked to get on board with a whole new way of looking at the world and of looking at people that didn't sit well. It didn't ring true, and it doesn't ring true. And that's really kind of why Don't Divide Us became more than just a kind of regular meeting online for frustrated parents and teachers. And we decided that we had to be more active and more proactive in calling out what we see as a very pernicious and socially divisive ideology.
Okay, so when you first started, what were sort of your first priority, if you like, to try and enact some change? And did you try and straight away sort of go for the government and try and raise it with them? Or did you try to raise it with individual schools?
No, we didn't really start officially trying to reach official lobbying circles, if you like, till much later. I didn't actually start off thinking, oh, I want to lead Don't Divide Us. I was a retired kind of teacher and academic and quite happy kind of pootling in my garden and thinking about writing a book. But it so happened that because of my experience and expertise in the field of education, I was able to sort of put what was happening in a bigger picture to parents and things. So initially we started really with just responding to parents, helping them write letters, rehearsing with them how they might raise their questions with schools, trying to put out things on a when we were able to get enough donations to set up a website. You know, we sort of thought, well, you know, try and put materials on there for parents and for teachers. But the problem with that approach, that kind of casework approach, is that it just sort of deals with individual things. It doesn't really impact on a wider picture. And we could see that a pattern was emerging. It wasn't just one or two schools. It was across the country. And that was when we thought we really had to look at, we didn't think we'd have much joy with the Department of Education at a national level, but we thought at local level, we have local education authorities. And there's there's more possibility of some democratic accountability in principle. In reality, they try all kinds of things to ensure they're insulated from democratic accountability. But in theory, that was possible. So we decided to produce a report through doing freedom of information requests to a large sample of local authorities to find out what kind of anti-racist materials and companies they were endorsing, which ones they were using. And through that, that report helped us to uncover, if you like, the kind of methods and operations of these third-party organisations that are really very undemocratic. There's no accountability at all with them.
So just to give you an idea to the listeners, what type of materials are being taught to children through these organisations? You know, what type of messages do kids receive?
Well, so there's sort of two related questions there, the materials and the message. I mean, the materials vary a lot. Some are far worse than others. Quite often when you come across, say, a reading list of a third party organisation in equity, diversity and inclusion, it won't be unusual to find a mixture of, for example, you know, some good or reasonable literature along with other books that are not literature at all. They're just pure propaganda. And others are just pure propaganda. But the thing is, it's the way the whole effort is framed, you know, and this is the message. The message is, as we are racist. But whether you like it or not, whether you know it or not, we're systematically racist. We can't help but be racist because of some original sin that happened in America with slavery, in Britain with its empire. So it's in terms of knowledge, it's incredibly reductive. It's a really reductive history. Ethically, it's telling a very negative and untrue, actually, it's an untrue story that we're being asked to believe, that any country is nothing but, you know, unmitigated sin and horribleness, and that somehow that trauma, like oxygen, kind of carries down through time and across space. So even if you're like doing really well in London or New York today, you're a young black entrepreneur, you're working in the arts in Britain, you're working in the BBC, you have a huge platform, you earn a reasonable wage, but somehow we're meant to believe that no, you are still oppressed, you know, you still suffer this trauma. And of course, what that does is leave the people who are really at the bottom of the pile, whether they're white or black, completely out of the picture. See, so it's very much an elite thing. And it's being presented as if it were a continuation of an older classical, liberal, respectable fight against racism. And it isn't. It's actually re-racializing society. It's not helping us to overcome and for us all to be our better selves as human beings. It's presenting a very divided story.
I think it's really interesting to see the changes within the narrative, you know, out in the ether of mainstream media, because yet we can see the most diversity within, you know, high stake, high paid jobs with some real influence in the country that are occupied by the essentially non-white people, because I think sometimes sort of saying that it's all about black or white sort of races really isn't explanatory enough, because what they quite often mean is non-white. Yet we've got a lot of people clearly in positions of power. Yet at the same time, we are supposed to believe that every single organization, every single association, even our countryside is somehow racist. But the entire conversation is just really, really blunt. There is zero tolerance for alternative views. As soon as you start quoting certain facts of the history, you're being called a bigot. So that movement didn't actually start in schools as such. That sort of trickled down to schools. And I think a lot of people actually blame academia for creating that sort of movement in the first place. So you were obviously in academia in the times when a lot of these critical race theories, queer theories really started getting traction. Was that something that you noticed when you were just out and about, you know, doing, focusing on your own career?
Absolutely, Kat. I mean, I think it, two things. I've been a teacher for most of my professional life, and then I took time out to look after the kids. And then when I went back into teaching, I was really shocked at the kinds of things I saw happening in schools. Now, it was very unclear to me what the reasons for that was, because there seemed to be a mixture of things. It wasn't at that point, we're talking about, I don't know, maybe the 2000s, mid to late 2000s. There was a mixture, there was a combination of a kind of very technocratic managerialism in British schools, where the kind of teaching as a creative, as a humane endeavour was being really squeezed out, in a kind of technocratic way. It was like, you've got to get the grades, you've got to work out percentages. Every 2 days, you've got to input data to see how your pupils are progressing, to see if the school's going to get the target, to see if the school will then do well on the league tables, et cetera, et cetera. That is quite a hostile environment to a liberal education. So there was a sort of an atmosphere where, if you like, the legitimate authority and ways of teaching were already being squeezed out. On top of that, you then have this turbo drive politicization with identity politics. And for many young people, I could see that it would be attractive because it was presenting them with a very emotionally charged moral purpose that would be much...
And a simple narrative.
Exactly. And when I returned to education after looking after the children, because I couldn't understand what was going on, I decided to do a PhD. I spoke with my husband and we said, well, go and study this and find out what's going on. So I started my PhD part-time. I continued work teaching while I was studying. And that gave me, I saw some very, very disturbing things there. My PhD was in the philosophy and sociology of education. And it was looking at knowledge in particular. And what I found really disturbing was the prevalence of what they call standpoint epistemology in academic terms. And that's like a very radical form of constructivism, which is the idea that there isn't anything objective about knowledge. Knowledge is something that is entirely constructed. And therefore, if it can be constructed, it can be just as easily deconstructed and reconstructed again, according to who is the dominant voice at that time. That's not how knowledge works. That's not how formal academic knowledge works at all. And I could see very corrosive effects of this, because it meant there's no, if you subscribe to that, then you have no standard of truth or truthfulness. It just becomes a game of power, and power becomes the criteria for what is good and what is bad rather than truthfulness. So I was very, really, really disturbed by that. That was kind of what I explored in my PhD a bit and then in my subsequent writings afterwards. So yes, it was, you know, the intellectual creation of this was in has been in academia. If it had stayed within academic circles, it would probably be far less harmful than it is now. But even in academia, it was beginning to spill over into not just seminar rooms, but into hiring practices, into routes of progression within academia. So it was altering the very ethos of the institution, not just what was taught in seminars. And now you have that in primary schools, which is just, you know, civilizational suicide, essentially, if you're teaching those very, very negative, nihilistic beliefs to primary school children. It can only mean you have absolutely no confidence or faith or love of where you live, of the culture that you live in, of civilization, really. It's incredibly, incredibly destructive.
It's heartbreaking as well, watching it done, you know, to a country. I mean, I'm a first generation immigrant. I'm so grateful for all opportunities that I was given over here and sort of managed to take advantage of and build an amazing life. And yet, you know, despite my experience, all I'm hearing out there is just how terrible this country is. But just on a really basic understanding of what it is that we are doing, we are pitting not only men against women, we are pitting different races against each other, we are pitting different classes against each other. That leads to war. At some point, it leads to war. If people can't agree on the most basic facts, people will start fighting for power, especially the people that are constantly being told that they are somehow being privileged, whilst that they are living in a forgotten town like Grimsby or Middlesbrough. It's very difficult to feel like you've got white privilege there. What's the point? Like, I'm really trying not to go down the conspiracy theories, because quite often these things are just incompetence and toxic compassion all the way down, you know, from the senior management to the lower people that are actually implementing this. But we don't seem to just look at it at very, very basic terms of what we are doing to children.
No, you're absolutely right. It is heartbreaking. My parents were immigrants, first generation immigrants to Britain, and they built a life for themselves here, a very nice life. And I've certainly had everything I've done, you know, my family, my academic achievements, my career, my profession, it's been in Britain, right? And you know, yes, I've had racism. I'm not going to go into, competitive victimhood. It's been not as bad as other people have experienced, I know. And it's been, I just don't understand. I think it is actually psychologically harmful to encourage people to retrospectively view their lives through the prism of victimhood and to understand their relationships today in the prism of victimhood. I mean, it's so negative. It can only make you feel very uncertain, very unconfident, very suspicious. These are not, sometimes you need to be suspicious, sure, but, you know, as a way of life, as a kind of normative way of viewing yourself and of viewing people, it's, why do that? It's really horrible. I don't think it's a conspiracy like you, but I think...
I actually don't, but sometimes it's almost like difficult
not to,
to feel like somebody is not trying to do this, because they seem to be doing such a good job, you know, with just poisoning our society.
It is an elite project. This is what confuses people. People think it might be something like from ground up. It's something like associated with, say, older type left wing politics or social, you know, sort of extending equality. And it has to be kind of unmasked a bit, really. That look, where this is coming from, what it is saying, prevents any kind of solidarity. I think there are certainly activists, the people who are deliberately wanting to do this, particularly in education, as it happens, I think. There's a whole new, we have allowed a whole new layer of a profession to be constructed, the equity, diversity and inclusion profession. That has now emerged as a kind of an actual thing, you know, and it's there in private corporations, it's there in public institutions, it's there in libraries, it's there in, you know, any aspect of public civic life now has to show how it's addressing equity and inclusion and diversity. So in that sense, it's quite systematic, but, you know, people involved don't necessarily see it like that. They just see it as, oh, let's just be nice, you know.
It's a really big business as well, and growing business. So there was this organization very recently, Conservative Way Forward, that has found that just under £500 million in the UK is spent on diversity and inclusion roles. This is just within the public sector, so paid by the taxpayers, really. When we start looking at the private sector on top of that, we are talking about multi-billion industry that grew out of teaching businesses, children, and everyone around them. Highly contested theories that don't seem to be actually moored to the truth.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? It's extraordinary how that's happened. Well, this is what I mean, you see. It's kind of like, you know, in Britain, you've had the expansion of higher education since about the late 80s, early 90s. Successive governments have said we want to expand higher education. But at the same time, and no one's really been looking at, well, what has higher education been doing? What's happening in terms of the curriculum in higher education? What kinds of courses are there? What kind of beliefs are being instilled there? And that's where a lot of this highly relativistic and this, you know, radical political ideas have been percolating, right? And they've been, and once you abandon the idea of truthful knowledge or disciplinary knowledge, or rather you sideline it and you sort of sneer at it. Oh, that's really old fashioned. That's not trendy. That's not going to address the problems we have today, as if we suddenly have a whole new set of problems that no human being has ever thought of before. It's, you know, it's like trashing centuries worth of intellectual and cultural inheritance that the next generation need to be taught. They need to be introduced to. Not because we want them to believe exactly the same that we believe, or we want them to be replicas of us, but they need that knowledge. They need to be able to think in those more abstract ways if they're going to make the world when they become adults better, you know, if they want to improve it. And instead of which, we're just closing that down and just offering them really divisive, poor intellectual quality knowledge and beliefs, really. It's horrible. Sorry, I'm sounding really negative here, aren't I? Really negative. There is hope.
Yeah. Don't worry, we'll get to that. I mean, I'm a parent of a young toddler. He doesn't go to school or a preschool or any one of these things yet. But he will start going to some sort of nursery or preschool very soon, couple of sort of mornings a week. And I am quite frankly petrified, because I am not happy with what I found in the current schools that are around us. So my choice is to either keep him at home and try home education, or private school, or send him to a public school and argue with the teachers and the head teachers, because the policies that I've seen there are worrying. And it's not just critical race theory, we are looking at queer theory now as well. So there is just so many pernicious, very, very toxic things that are just in ether. And to an extent, I was actually hoping that I might be shielded from it a little bit. We are in the northwest of England. in a countryside, and I thought, oh, maybe it's still in the metropolitan areas. But no, the friend of mine, her son was recently accused by the teacher of being homophobic because he didn't agree to pretend that his work colleague was a horse. And then the boy had to educate his teacher that that's not actually homophobic and that he isn't homophobic because his uncle is gay. So to suggest that he's somehow homophobic, he just basically told the teacher that that's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, fair point to that kid, like, well done, kid, for standing up for yourself. But these are young
kids. They shouldn't have to be doing that.
They shouldn't need to be. Yeah, like they literally should. Their worries at the age of 11 and 12 is, you know, what are they going to be doing this weekend with their mates? What are they going to be doing in terms of the play? And, you know, maybe starting to figure whether they can maybe invite a girl out on a prom or something, or, you know, whatever. Trying to make politics and introduce it to their lives so early on, we're just stealing their childhoods.
I think that's right. I mean, I know that when I've talked to friends of mine, they say, but Alka, you know, you can't get away from politics. schools are political places. And in a very banal sense, that's true, because politics is where we make the arrangements for all of society. So, you know, that's true. But the point is, I think, there's, you know, the really important distinction between children and adults is completely destroyed if you think that schools are not about and are not places where you can talk about politics at the right age, when children are developing and they're beginning to look more broadly at the outside world. And then, you know, of course they're going to hear about political things, and you may wish to discuss that with them in the classroom. But that's one thing, but that's not what we're talking about, because what has happened is that now schools themselves are seen as the tool for making political change itself. You see, it's no longer politics as a form of knowledge, it's now schools as politics. And in fact, I was in a discussion on a panel with some teacher educators at the Institute of Education, which is in London, you know, one of the most prestigious teacher education places, institutions in Britain. It's where I went to in the early 90s, and I was worried then, and I'm even more worried now. and one of the panelists who worked at this institution, you know, and I voiced my concerns. I said, I think what you're proposing is making schools political sites. And that's, for me, that's anti-democratic, because you're bypassing the necessity of having to persuade your fellow citizens in the adult world. Instead, you're using a captive audience of children, which is, you know, illegitimate. It's illegitimate educationally, and it's anti-democratic more widely. And she just said, this was her response, it's almost word for word, was like, well, Alka, politics takes too much time. We've got to use the classrooms. And that mindset is the activist mindset. Now, there was another person on that panel, and I bet he didn't really agree with her. And I think that because a lot of the things that I was saying about knowledge and the curriculum, he was kind of nodding along with. But every time he spoke, he felt he had to say, of course I agree with social justice, of course we have to be anti-racist. And this was an older professor. He was experienced, he was, you know, he was working at the Institute as well, but he felt he was unable or unwilling to be courageous enough to say what he really thought, which I bet would have been, this is nonsense, you know. I bet, you know, it's just, and this is the problem. An individual, you know, because we have no political representation, there's no political party with a vision of education that could do the things that need to be done, that could help change things around in schools. it means that parents and teachers were just left as individuals to face, to try and deal with the situation as best we can. So there are things that you can do as a parent and as a teacher, but they will be, I fear, in the short term, in the immediate term, quite limited. The fight will have to be in the political sphere.
Okay, I mean, we will come to these in a minute, because I still want to give the audience some sort of tools, because I do have hope for the long term, but I've got quite a pessimistic overview of the next 5 to 10 years. I don't see how the political is going to change with our next most likely government, who vehemently supports critical theory and wants to introduce it to schools as a status quo, as if it's not already a status quo in schools. Perhaps some schools are still shielded from it. But this heart, this creep of let's change people's opinions on what we class as important topics is not quite new. And I started noticing, I mean, I don't come from politics at all. For years and years, I was essentially in the online business space. But that's where I could see it very, very early. And it started with patriarchy, where essentially every single time a woman felt like she couldn't quite achieve something, or that a guy spoke to her a particular way that was mansplaining, it was all patriarchy. And that was just absolutely rife within the online space. Then obviously came the critical race theory. And obviously during the pandemic, after the death of George Floyd, as we do with a lot of problems of America, we decide to import them to the UK. And then a lot of the businesses, online businesses, were literally falling over each other to sort of claim how anti-racist they are. And now it's actually very difficult to find a business course that doesn't teach you about the fact that punctuality or being on time or being conscientious is white privilege, which, I mean, I find it so offensive to anyone that isn't white, because being conscientious, for example, is one of the hallmarks of perhaps actually reaching success within the professional life. So to say that, to call that anti-racism and say that Black or, you know, Asian people are not that,
yeah,
it's just ludicrous.
It is very, very patronizing and offensive. That's true. You asked about like strategies that you can, I mean, I agree with you on the political prognosis that clearly, with, you know, if, as it looks likely, Labour come to power at the next election. You know, they are quite explicit about making what is already happening, entrenching it further and endorsing it further. And of course, it will give a lot of confidence to people who are working in that sector, who are the activists at the moment, who, you know, might be a little bit on the back foot. Every so often you get a bit of a pushback, like with the Cass report on the transgender issue or the Forstatter case. And there are individual cases of people pushing back against critical race theory being imposed on them in their workplace training programs. But those kinds of cases, you know, they have a limited effect. You know, they'll provide a little bit of a confidence, but it's not the same as having a political party that can clearly articulate a positive vision of what it wants for society, of what it wants the health service to be, of what it wants businesses to be, schools to be. We don't have that. That's our big problem. However, what we can do on an individual level is to be the better person, or, you know, be the calmer one, do the work. When you're being presented with some material that you think is just pure assertion with no evidence, we don't even need to like go in all guns blazing, just to ask, sorry, but why have you come to this conclusion? You know, or this seems to be addressing a problem of racism or homophobia. What evidence do we have that we have this problem in this workplace? And more often than not, the response will be, to ignore that question and then talk about disparities on a huge scale. But then you need to say, then I think you just need to say, you know, that may or may not be the case. We can dispute the interpretation of these statistics. But the point is, here in Middlesbrough, here in, you know, Norwich, in this school, in this company, in this hospital, we don't have a problem. So, but we do have a problem with not enough school books, or, you know, not enough teachers, or not enough GPs. So should we, can we focus on improving our core mission, our core services first? And I think if we take that kind of approach, then, you know, some people have managed to, you know, get the school perhaps to at least, if nothing else, they've let it be known that there's another viewpoint, you know, and a viewpoint that is worth listening to. And I think, you know, that's kind of thing I would advise people to do.
Now, recently you published a chapter in the Handbook on Curriculum and Education that was published in this month, actually, still in April 2024, as we are recording it on the last day of the month. And what is this handbook doing in terms of influencing policy? So is that handbook going to be then read by the policymakers to try and sort of base their decision on?
Well, if I had my way, it would be read by everybody in the Department of Education. I don't know who will read it. I would hope that they would read it. We've certainly sent it to the, you know, advisors that we know and whichever individuals. But beyond that, you can't kind of, there's no way of knowing whether they're going to read it or not. The handbook will be sent to institutions, education departments and universities and libraries as well. It's an academic book, so it is very expensive, unfortunately. But it is a very good... Well, it's a brilliant enterprise, really, because the editor, Professor Elizabeth Rata, has called upon academics and professionals across the world, really. It's very international. So it does, you know, from that, you can get a very good sense of the scope of what, you know, what is happening in the world of knowledge and in the world of school subjects. So it's not just aimed at policymakers, it is actually aimed at teachers and teacher educators as well. Not all teachers will be interested in it because not all, sadly, we have a very anti-intellectual teaching profession. You know, it's kind of like a lot of teachers are very keen on research, but there are the idea of research without having properly immersed yourself in the literature beforehand is just a joke, really. And so teacher educate, you know, when you train to be a teacher, it's very unlikely, unless you're lucky, that you'll be come across the philosophy of education or sociology or how to even study social science statistics properly. Instead, you'll be introduced to critical social justice and feminism and those kinds of theories. So we're hoping the book will be a kind of a first salvo, if you like, in creating discussion and debate and more support for realists, I think, is what we'd call ourselves. We're all different political backgrounds, but educationally, I think we could say we're realists. We think knowledge is real, education is real, and it needs protecting from these influences.
I mean, your chapter was essentially a description of what education has been seen as, and then perhaps the turn that it took after the Second World War, when the education started being seen as a tool of not just education, but actually it had X amount of other sort of boxes to tick. And I found that particularly interesting because obviously I was already educated sort of in the period after that. But I can still sort of notice that within the education system, like as I was being educated, and I was educated in Poland, sort of through up to the high school, there was definitely like a picture painted of, for example, certain parties that were more right than the others. There was already, you know, a very high or very heavy emphasis of, for example, the really liberal ideas in general. So we sort of, we were taught other ideas, clearly sort of being from Poland, that's sort of baked into our history. But do you think that the fact that we are now so, so ready to sort of take on these really divisive ideas, part of the fact that we were educated in school in a particular way to sort of just allow people to get away with quite divisive ideas, because that's sort of part of the liberal country that we live in?
I wouldn't blame the schools that you or I mean, I was educated here as well in quite a liberal way. I think the key, even though I think the overall ethos might have been a kind of a more liberal than, say, small c conservative, the key factor for me would be the extent to which the curriculum itself was respected. Because, you see, if a school, you know, a school might have, say, I don't know, 30-40% of teachers who are left-wing, for example, and maybe the conservative ones feel a bit intimidated and they don't speak up very much, for example. But if that school is committed to, is still teaching a curriculum that is based on disciplinary knowledge in schools, in traditional school subjects, then that means that they will be teaching and also if they're allowed to teach in a way that is not tightly prescribed, so that they can pay attention to discussion, you know, specifically in history and the social science or humanities subjects, where discussion is a very important part of the pedagogy, right? It's not like mathematics or science where you have to do practical experiments or you have to learn very tight rules, you know, in sequence. You have more freedom, more flexibility in the arts and the sciences. But that does mean you have to have a very good, a very strong criteria of the books that you're choosing. Are the history books good history books? Are the literature books good literature books? Those standards have been in place kind of, I think, without much thinking, just sort of automatically they've been accepted for the most part of the 20th century. But towards the latter part of the 20th century, those standards themselves within the school curriculum began to be first questioned, then more challenged, and now openly rejected as being oppressive. That's the crucial thing that I think has created, if you like, the intellectual culture in which this new radical politics sits very comfortably. But I mean, I wouldn't. That's a really long-term process thing. More immediately, it's a political question. It's the fact that our political class is unable to challenge it. You know, it's look at the Conservative Party. You have a few individuals who are very courageous and speak out, but they're staying in a party that is incoherent. So they're not going to. They're going their ability to challenge this and produce something better is very limited. So I think it's a combination of kind of proximal, immediate political problems with that longer, much, much longer intellectual decline, I think.
Bearing in mind that it is in a sphere of political that this is going to be fought over and hopefully won over the next, let's say, 10, 15, 20.
Who knows how many.
How can people find you online? Where can they support the work of Don't Divide Us? And what have you got coming up in the foreseeable future?
Right. Well, to visit our website, don'tdivideus.com. There you will find copies of our two reports that we've produced. You'll find the campaigns that we've been involved with. We're not a charity, so we can't apply for big funding. So we rely on public donations. So if you like what you see, please do support us. In terms of what we've got coming up, at the minute we're planning some projects around the Equality Act and continuing to develop our work around education and school curriculum in particular. But as I said, that's in the planning stage at the moment. But if you want to join us, it would be wonderful. I mean, we hold we hold meetings online and occasionally in person, but that's not on a regular basis as yet.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Alka Segal Cuthbert. Thank you for tuning in to Wisdom Rebellion. Come and join the conversation on our YouTube channel and socials. The links are in the show notes. And don't forget to follow, rate, and subscribe to the show so we can all build a wiser world together.